from South Dakota to Alabama, Missouri to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, no air travel, no children, no cheeseburgers. All are policy proposals advanced by radical environmentalists. Nick Loris of the Heritage Foundation is here with details. A health issue forced Senator Bernie Sanders off the campaign trail this past week. What impact will that have on the race for the Democratic presidential nomination? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Naloxone has proven effective in reversing opioid overdoses, so why isn't it available over the counter? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores the issue with Jeff Singer of the Cato Institute. And it's time for Americans to slow down, put down their phones, and re-engage in the world around them. So says Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Green New Deal contains a wide range of outlandish environmental policy proposals, but even that isn't radical enough for some left-wing activists. Nick Loris is deputy director of the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. He is here to take a look at some of these proposals. Nick, welcome to American Radio Journal. Nick, as we look at the Green New Deal, which might be turning out to be the more sensible, to the degree anything is sensible, of the various environmental proposals that are being kicked around, we're seeing a lot of very strange proposals. Let's talk about a few of them today because some of them are really off the wall. And let's start, first of all, there has been a proposal by various candidates for the Democrat presidential nomination, various members of Congress, about shutting down air travel because they don't want the use of fossil fuels. So is that even possible?
It's not. If you look at, one, just what the people living in our non-contiguous states and if people who want to travel abroad would have to do, it just technologically makes little sense. And maybe we'll see some improvements in biofuels or electric batteries to change the way that airplanes are powered. But at the same time, just simply saying that everyone is going to somehow transition to high-speed rail and ignore air travel altogether would not only be immensely costly to the point where people probably wouldn't travel anymore, but it is technologically not feasible to get certain places without the luxury of air travel. I think a lot of people hail air travel as one of the great modern inventions of our time because it has made getting across the country, seeing family, seeing relatives, taking nice vacations so much easier and so much more affordable than it was in the past that we should be happy that we have this at our disposal, not demonizing it.
You mentioned high-speed rail. California has been attempting to develop high-speed rail. That's gotten costly to the point that have they now even just decided to shut down the effort?
Yeah, that's essentially right. And if they can't do it in California, what is that to say that is going to happen in the rest of the country? And you know, maybe I would have a little more confidence if the private sector was driving high-speed rail, because I think you can use different sorts of transportation innovation to change the way people get from point A to point B. I mean, private buses that operate from D.C. to New York have become very, very popular and are very, very affordable as a result. And so there are potentially more cost-efficient ways of traveling, but high-speed rail has been not only a taxpayer-funded debacle, it just hasn't even been able to get through the environmental review and permitting processes because of where the rail would need to go.
Even if we were to segue into using more high-speed rail and less air travel, Nick, since the goal of the environmental left is to not reduce but completely eliminate the use of fossil fuels, would not fossil fuels still be needed? Somehow you have to power the high-speed trains. Somehow you have to produce the steel and other materials. So from that point of view, is a net no use of fossil fuels, it sounds pretty far-fetched.
Yeah, it's not only very, very costly and far-fetched and technologically challenging because the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun doesn't shine all the time, and we don't have cost-efficient battery technology to back it up for those times when it is intermittent. But as you mentioned, I think this is a very good point, is that there are environmental costs to every type of energy source that we produce. And so you do have to mine the lithium to produce the batteries, the steel, and the rare earth minerals for wind turbines and for solar panels. And so all of these things have environmental costs as well. Not to mention, if we were to ban fracking and shut down oil and gas production in the United States, that's not going to stop the consumption of these resources abroad. What this is merely going to do is shift production to places around the world that are far less safe than the United States and far less environmentally conscious than the United States produces oil and gas. And so you're just shifting emissions to other countries where there's a good chance that the environmental outcome could actually be worse.
We are talking with Nick Loris of the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about various left-wing environmental proposals. And aside, Nick, from the war on fossil fuels, we actually have members of Congress who are proposing that we just need to stop having children in order to save the environment. What are they talking about here?
It's mind-boggling, and it's again, you know, population control is something that's been talked around and I think laughed at for a long time. But I think for people who are seriously concerned about climate change, they are very serious about the idea that we should limit population growth. And again, this is what we think of when we think of China's children policy. It's not something that you think of that happens in places like the United States and the rest of the developed world. Not to mention, I think it's a bit counterintuitive, because I think if you actually are worried about climate change, more children and more people could actually be the solution, because it provides more people that might have innovative ideas that could be part of a solution rather than part of the problem. They could be innovators and come up with different sorts of entrepreneurial ideas to mitigate or adapt to climate change. This is kind of what Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Romer talked about, is that this just creates a market for more innovation, not just in the environmental landscape, but also for medicines, for energy, for transportation, whatever the case may be.
They also are proposing that, and this has even been picked up by a number of Democratic presidential candidates, that we should stop eating red meat, that we should not have cattle because cattle, shall we say, add to the CO2 levels of the environment. This whole idea of banning red meat and altering diets, is that likely to have any significant impact on the environment?
It won't. Mostly because the rest of the world isn't going to follow suit, especially the developing world. So in terms of actually mitigating global temperatures, it's like unlikely to have any meaningful impact. And again, I think what part of the problem here is that there's the federal government and politicians nudging people into certain behaviors and activities, automatically thinking that those behaviors and activities are better for people, when in fact it might make them worse by taking away choice and the ability to buy whatever food product or use any energy source that they want. And we've seen kind of slow creeps of this through energy efficiency mandates for appliances and light bulbs, for fuel economy standards for vehicles, and changing people's diets is kind of the latest fad to do this. And again, that's not to say if people want plant-based burgers or if they want lab-grown meat, more power to them. I think we can certainly have more innovation in the food landscape, but the numbers of those products being consumed worldwide, even though they have increased, pales in comparison to the amount of beef burgers and beef products that are consumed.
We have again been talking with Nick Loris, who is Deputy Director of the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies, that at the Heritage Foundation. And Nicholas, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation, where folks can go to read more about not only these ideas, but some sensible ideas that have been proposed by the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that advocates for public policies based on limited government and individual responsibility and free enterprise. You can check us out at heritage.org, as well as our sister organization, The Daily Signal, which is thedailysignal.com.
Nick Loris of the Heritage Foundation. Nick, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, doing double duty this week, keeping an eye both on what's happening in Washington and Congress, as well as the campaign trail. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Loman.
Scott, it seems like impeachment, 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 investigation, investigation, investigation is all that we're hearing out of the Capitol. Has it, in fact, sucked all the oxygen out of everything else that Congress needs to be doing at the moment?
Well, it certainly has, Loman. Right now, the House and Senate are out of session for 2 weeks, and they'll be returning in the middle of October. So there's a lot going on sort of on the sidelines in addition to the official work that normally takes place here in Washington. We're seeing a lot of talk about what Adam Schiff knew and when he knew it and what that means for the rest of the Democratic leadership and their posturing with impeachment of President Trump.
There are a number of critical items that should be dominating the congressional agenda, which are not. Chief among them, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement. This is something that the Trump administration has brought close to fruition. Is there any movement in Congress toward getting this treaty ratified?
Yeah, so I talked to White House sources this week. I think that they remain optimistic that they can work with the Democrats to try to get the USMCA across the finish line. But I also think the reality is that the Democrats have repeatedly been stalling the negotiations in order to put this into the presidential cycle and prevent President Trump from getting in any sort of a big win when it comes to a new free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico. And when you think about what's really good in the USMCA, we always think about free enterprise and free trade here at the Club for Growth. Certainly a free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico through the USMCA is better than no free trade agreement. What it does is it creates an opportunity to have cheaper imports, more exports. It creates an opportunity for more GDP, which will increase wages and full-time jobs in the U.S. economy. So we want to see the USMCA get across the finish line. But I think that there are more and more people that are also realistic that this might be just another episode of Charlie Brown. In addition to that, there's a need for Congress to pass appropriations legislation again. And we're continuing to operate underneath these so-called CRs, these continuing resolutions right now. And the current one will expire in November. So it'll be interesting to see whether we have any breakthrough with the appropriations negotiations. Sometimes it's not about the dollars. It's all about the policy writers that get included and whether there are poison pills. This is the reality of divided government, right? You need to be able to have bipartisan consensus to get legislation signed into law. And we've seen exactly what the Democrats have been doing in attacking the president, and he's ultimately the one that needs to sign these bills into law. So I think we should remain skeptical to whether there are any big breakthroughs on the appropriations or on the big trade agreement here with Canada and Mexico.
So we're not expecting much out of Congress. Let's turn our attention now, Scott, to the presidential campaign trail. This week, the big news was that Senator Bernie Sanders had a heart episode, ended up in the hospital, had surgery. What impact is this going to have on the Democratic primary?
It remains to be seen. So we know that the next Democrat debate is going to be October 15th, based out of Ohio. That'll be a CNN and New York Times debate. And whether Senator Sanders is able to participate remains to be seen. He had a very, very strong quarter in fundraising, raising $25 million. And in the meantime, you're seeing other candidates full steam ahead with their own candidacy. And whether Senator Sanders is healthy enough to step up on the debate stage or if it takes him a couple of months to get back into the swing of things, he's certainly got the money to be able to sit and wait. But his campaign this week, they actually did cancel $1.3 million in reserved ad times. So we're going to be watching closely. I think naturally when you look at Bernie Sanders' socialist agenda and the ideas that he proposes, you're seeing a lot of people go from Bernie Sanders to Liz Warren to Joe Biden, back and forth, back and forth. And those are sort of the three that are peaking as folks like Kamala Harris are totally in the decline. But don't forget, Mayor Pete also raised a lot of money, and so did Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang raised over $10 million for somebody that I think a lot of people hadn't heard of in the last couple of months. This is going to be a very competitive presidential primary on the Democrat side. I think that President Trump is starting to recognize who the front runners are and take his shots when he sees fit. But more than anything, it's about being patient, letting the process unfold, and seeing who emerges to take on President Trump in 2020.
Is all of this bad news for frontrunner Joe Biden, Scott? First of all, as you mentioned, Elizabeth Warren has been on the upswing, and she's somewhat emerged as one of the primary challenges to Joe Biden's frontrunner status. And also, Biden and his son Hunter have become totally embroiled in this Ukrainian controversy. Does all of this really put him back on his heels at this point?
Well, I think he's certainly on his heels. He's been sort of on defense, even though he's the front runner. And as he's tried to punch up against President Trump, everybody else has been punching at him. I mentioned that Kamala's in the decline, and last week she went ahead and tried to stand up for Joe Biden, saying leave him alone. But he has a campaign where he's polling very strongly still. Hasn't totally hit rock bottom by any means. He could still go down, but he also hasn't peaked. So if you see a front runner like Bernie Sanders suspend a campaign or decide to drop out, I think that the support is going to be going to folks like Joe Biden, like Liz Warren, like Mayor Pete, and maybe even a couple of dark horses.
We have again been talking with Scott Parkinson, who is at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. We have over 250,000 members from all 50 states in the union that are united in the belief to promote economic liberty and economic opportunity and freedom. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, they can look us up on our website, www.clubforgrowth.org. Or they can look us up on social media. Our Twitter handle is @ClubForGrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll talk with you again next week. Take care.
Okay, thank you.
In the fight to lower opioid overdose deaths, naloxone has proven to be highly effective. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jeff Singer of the Cato Institute on why the FDA should make naloxone available for over-the-counter sales. Eric?
America's opioid crisis is really a fentanyl crisis, and the fentanyl crisis is largely a prohibition crisis. But unfortunately, the federal government is engaging in even more prohibition in slowing down the deployment of one of the drugs that could be used to help undo the fentanyl crisis in the first place. And that was the point that was raised by Jeffrey Singer and some other experts from the Cato Institute at an event that was hosted this week at the Rayburn House Office Building that's part of the Congressional Complex or campus down in Washington, D.C. And the point that these experts, including Dr. Singer from the Cato Institute, raised is that the FDA is dragging its feet in approving a drug called naloxone that could significantly decrease the number of people who die from opioid-related overdoses. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Not a traditional interview this week, but I did get the chance to sit down with Jeffrey Singer, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, after that event on Wednesday afternoon and talk a little bit about what naloxone is and why it could be the key to slowing or stopping many of the overdose deaths that have skyrocketed in America over the last few years. Just for context here, demand for black market opioids has increased largely in response to the availability of prescription opioids, and there's been a corresponding spike in the use of fentanyl, which is, of course, illegal and 50 times more potent than heroin, but it's become widely available on the street. It's a powerful drug being marketed as a less powerful drug, and it has produced a corresponding increase in overdose deaths. 48,000 Americans overdosed on opioids in 2017, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, with synthetic opioids like fentanyl responsible for 29,000 and probably more of those deaths. While the overall number of overdose deaths have doubled since 2013, the number of deaths resulting from the use of synthetic opioids has increased by 9 times. So I sat down, as I said, with Jeffrey Singer from the Cato Institute to talk a little bit about how naloxone could be part of the solution to this obvious public health crisis. But before we talked about the details here, we had to cover exactly what naloxone is, because I imagine there's a lot of people out there who have probably never heard of this drug. So that's the first thing I asked him. What is naloxone, and what does it do?
Everyone agrees, regardless of where anybody stands on the drug war, everybody agrees this is a lifesaver. It's an antidote. So when you inject it or inhale it through a nasal spray, or it binds with the receptors in the nervous system that opioids bind to. And it's such a strong bind that it actually displaces the opioids that are bound to those receptors, pushes them away, and stays bound to them. But once it binds to those receptors, it's inactive. It doesn't do anything. So it's a blocker. So people who are not breathing because they have too many opioids in their system, this pushes those opioid molecules off of the receptors and takes their place and resuscitates a person.
For now, naloxone is available in most states by going to a pharmacy and asking for it. You just have to walk up to the counter and say that you want it. You don't need a doctor's prescription, although, of course, you do have to pay for it. The drug is easy to use, and it can be safely administered with almost no training at all. There's actually two different variants of it, one that can be injected in a sort of EpiPen-type injection, and the other that comes in the form of a nasal spray. The drug was first approved by the FDA since 1971. It's totally safe to use, and anyone who walks up to a pharmacy counter can get it. But Singer says that even the barrier of having to go to the pharmacy counter can be too much, especially for the types of people who are most likely to need a life-saving injection or inhaler.
The fact that you have to, in this country, go up to a pharmacy counter in order to get naloxone is standing in the way of getting access to the people who need it. If we made it over the counter, that makes it available in 750,000 retail outlets across the country, not just pharmacies. That means Circle K's and 7-Elevens. Ideally, you could put it in vending machines.
There are, however, some who worry that such widespread access, like simply putting it in a vending machine, could create something like a moral hazard. That's a phrase that economists use to describe a situation where, once it becomes easier to avoid a deadly consequence, more people are willing to engage in dangerous behavior in the first place. Like seatbelts in cars, for example. Sure, they make you safer, but they might also encourage more dangerous driving. Now, there have been some studies looking at the availability of naloxone and whether that makes people more likely to use opioids in the first place because they know there's a way to save their lives if they need it. And there's been some mixed results on that. Some studies have found an increase in opioid-related emergency room visits after access to naloxone was expanded in certain states, but others have found a reduction in overall opioid-related deaths. And even that increase in emergency room visits could be a good thing, because naloxone might be buying people time to get their friends or other people they see who are overdosing to an emergency room when those people might have just died in the streets otherwise. So why isn't naloxone available over the counter? The FDA is partially at fault here, but not entirely. The agency has actually been asking drug companies to petition them for a reclassification of the drug. But under FDA rules, the agency doesn't necessarily have to wait until drug companies ask for that change at all. Technically, any interested person could request a review, or the FDA commissioner could just institute one preemptively. Here's how Singer describes the situation.
Is the commissioner could just decide, we're moving this over the counter, which has happened many times. There's a lot of cold remedies that you can get over the counter now. It used to be prescription only, and the FDA just said, we're making this over the counter. Prices dropped dramatically. So we're at a point now where the FDA said, we think this is ripe for review. So all we need you to do is officially request.
But if drug companies won't pick up the pace and get naloxone approved for over-the-counter sales, perhaps because they're worried that would cause the drug's price to fall, that's something that typically does happen when drugs are made available over the counter, then acting FDA Commissioner Norman Sharpless should just act unilaterally and do it. Because the FDA doesn't exist to protect drug companies' profits. It exists to evaluate the risks of allowing wider access to certain drugs. In this case, opioid overdoses are an exponentially greater threat to Americans than the misuse of naloxone. So Congress, the FDA, the drug companies, everyone who is holding up this process needs to get moving. Because while naloxone is not going to single-handedly put an end to the opioid crisis, it is certainly going to save lives. It's a way to bring down that spiking rate of overdose deaths that we've seen across the country in the last several years, and it just makes sense to make this as widely available as possible. You can check out Jeffrey Singer's work at cato.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
When was the last time you put down your cellular phone and just watched the world around you? Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College did just that, and he talks about his observations on this American Radio Journal commentary.
I sit in a car in a Starbucks parking lot in Wexford, Pennsylvania, a suburb north of Pittsburgh. But really, it could be any lot or suburb anywhere in America. It's a new Starbucks, a large lot, drive-thru. I wait while my daughter takes a music lesson down the road. The scene of the drive-thru strikes me. I'm dumbstruck by cars whizzing in at about 30 miles per hour with 40 yards to decelerate to a halt. I wonder how they'll do it without rear-ending the car stationary ahead. Not that the person in the car ahead is even noticing. She's looking at her phone. The remarkable displays of deceleration take me back to watching airplanes land a week earlier as I flew from Pittsburgh to LAX. I hate flying, and yet, as everyone says, you're safer in the skies than on the roads. My observations on this day in Wexford are further affirmation. In fact, any drive, any day is affirmation. How the highways of America don't resemble MASH units is hard to imagine beyond spiritual explanations, i.e., indisputable proof of the existence of guardian angels. Jarring me out of my trance while staring agape at SUVs screeching to a halt at the drive-thru is a large black Yukon that suddenly appears in my windshield and looks to crush me as it slams still in the space next to me at a speed that makes no rational sense whatsoever. I breathe a sigh of relief that I wasn't just maimed and expect the driver to dash inside yelling, "Dial 911!" Surely the guy's child is on fire in the back seat, right? Nope. He sits alone inside his vehicle for 10 minutes before calmly strolling inside. No hurry, he's just oblivious. That brings me to my struggle and my question here today in this commentary. What accounts for this kind of behavior endemic to modern America? We want to say it's busyness. Well, that's partly true. But my sense is it's more obliviousness than busyness. As a case in point, my other observation from the Starbucks lot. Directly ahead is an outdoor patio where customers suck on their $5 drinks. Today, however, there's something I've never witnessed before. There's a man struggling to shimmy down the flagpole in the middle of the patio. He's with a flagpole company. I know that because his work van says so. The poor guy adjusts, readjusts, loosens his gear. He's struggling. He's in a risky, if not perilous, situation. But what hits me particularly about the flagpole guy isn't his behavior, but those around him. Directly under him, sitting and sipping calmly at a table, is an adult man staring at his phone. The man is somehow unaware of the plight of the flagpole guy directly above him, including the bracing reality that if the flagpole guy falls, he'll land on the coffee man. The coffee man is clueless, as are the dozen or so patio people. As the flagpole guy sweats, the nonchalant people slurp. They are, in a word, oblivious, to the point of outright insensitivity to the flagpole guy's ordeal. Many of the drink sippers probably ferociously launched their SUVs into that parking lot 30 minutes before. What's going on here? I submit, again, it's less a matter of busyness than obliviousness. I fear that's what plagues our highways and byways and culture more than anything. And I don't know how you fix this, but a big step forward might be for all of us to break out of our shells, our vehicles, away from our screens, and just simply pay closer attention to people around us. Respect them and their dignity. They're people. Don't be too busy, and don't be oblivious. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include our newest affiliate, WMERAM in Meridian, Mississippi. Welcome to our new listeners in the Magnolia State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.